North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations. Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas and Go at the Y, and Gas and Go at Mill Bay.
On 100.1 FM, you are listening to KMXT Kodiak. And it is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Happy Juneteenth. It is currently 58 degrees in Kodiak. Out at the airport, they are showing northeast winds to 6 miles per hour, 10 miles of visibility under mostly cloudy skies. Look for a 50% chance of rain tonight. Mostly cloudy overnight with a low of 50. For tomorrow, rain is likely. That rain is likely to go through tomorrow night and into Wednesday morning. But then the rest of the week, they're reporting just scattered showers. Coming up on the Midday Report, advocates are hopeful two renewable energy bills will pass the state legislature next year. And an ambitious Anchorage Assembly goal for a low-barrier shelter.
After kicking off his re-election campaign in Philadelphia over the weekend, President Biden is in California today. NPR's Tamara Keith reports the president will be attending several fundraising events in his bid for a second term in the White House.
California has long been an ATM for political cash, and it is serving that role again as President Biden travels to scoop up big-dollar campaign contributions. The Biden campaign and Democratic National Committee have joint fundraising agreements with all 50 state parties, which means they can raise up to nearly $1 million from a single donor. The re-election campaign is making a major dash for cash in the closing half of this month, holding more than 20 fundraisers around the country, headlined by the president, vice president, first lady, or second gentleman. A campaign spokesman tells NPR more than half of the fundraisers will be headlined by the president himself. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Across the nation, Americans are marking Juneteenth with festivities great and small. In New Jersey, a social justice group is using this day to announce that it will tackle the issue of reparations. Nancy Solomon of member station WNYC reports.
The New Jersey Institute for Social Justice has created a reparations council that includes leading scholars and public policy experts. They'll study what laws could be changed to address racial justice and the possibility of a cash payment to the descendants of enslaved people. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, a professor at Harvard and co-chair, says they will take up the work that a stalled bill in the legislature intended to create.
The issue of reparations, perhaps in the state of New Jersey, remains controversial enough that some elected officials fear that there may be political backlash by moving forward.
The council plans to make its recommendations by Juneteenth, 2025. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
This is NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Two bills to advance renewable energy in Alaska stalled in the state legislature this year, but an alternative energy advocate thinks they have a good chance of becoming law in 2024. One bill would create a state green bank to help finance projects like rooftop solar. Chris Rose is executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project. He explains the need for a green bank by comparing renewables to cars in the Henry Ford days.
You couldn't get a car loan the day cars were invented. banks had to figure out what the risk profile of this contraption called a car was before they would decide to loan money for it. Well, with green financing, the banks have not had a lot of experience in what the risk profile is for lending somebody some money to make their home more energy efficient or to put solar panels on their house.
Rose says there is general agreement in the legislature on the merits of a green bank, and Governor Mike Dunleavy himself has introduced the bill twice.
Yeah, I think the green bank bill will pass next session. I don't think there's a lot of concern about it conceptually. I think people understand that what a fund like this at the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation could do is provide affordable loans to Alaskans.
The second bill would create a renewable portfolio standard. It would mandate that utilities get a certain percentage of their power from renewable sources like wind and solar. Rose sees this as the best way to fill the waning supply of natural gas in South Central Alaska and prevent skyrocketing utility bills.
The utility managers are all talking about importing liquefied natural gas to fill the gap that we're going to see just in about 3 or 4 years in Cook Inlet natural gas. Importing LNG is going to be 40, 50, 60% more expensive than the price of gas now.
Wind and solar, on the other hand, are now the cheapest sources of power and can be built relatively quickly, Rose says. He's optimistic that the renewable portfolio bill will also make it to the governor's desk next year. Rose hopes the committee chairs continue hearings on the bills this summer, but hasn't heard on any update on that yet. An ambitious Anchorage Assembly goal to get a new permanent low-barrier shelter up and running this fall is becoming less ambitious. The Assembly's lead on homelessness issues now says a new shelter likely won't open until the end of December, well into the season for preventable frostbite and outdoor deaths, and it will likely need emergency authorization to start off. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports that even that version of a shelter is far from certain.
Turnout was thin at recent town halls on shelter concepts, and the Assembly and mayor have clashed over which options the city should pursue.
If history is in any indication, if we approve a plan that does not have community buy-in, I have no faith that this administration will implement it.
That was Assembly Housing and Homelessness Committee Chair Felix Rivera back in March. His new target for getting a permanent shelter running is December 31st, with a new caveat that it would likely be under temporary emergency authority.
There's realistically and feasibly no other way that a shelter would get up and running by the end of this year, considering some of these processes, conditional use, rezoning, can take months and months and months, right?
That was Monday. His comments came just 6 weeks after the Assembly began shutting down its winter emergency shelters, the biggest of which was the Sullivan Arena. Local experts say about 700 people in Anchorage are now unsheltered. Using the arena was controversial. When the city opened it as a mass shelter during the pandemic, and again last fall when outdoor temperatures fell, it acted quickly with emergency powers. The shelter operators didn't need to meet licensing requirements adopted in 2021, and the site didn't have to fit normal zoning and land use rules. The Sullivan Arena gave hundreds of people with nowhere else to go refuge, but it could be chaotic. Public safety issues were frequent, inside and out. Advocates say those conditions and neighborhood impacts are not inherent to permanent low-barrier shelters. Owen Hutchinson, a spokesperson for the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, said what spills out into a neighborhood is a reflection of what's going on inside a shelter.
It's really a mirror. So if in a shelter things are really chaotic and unsafe, things will be chaotic and unsafe for those individuals outside the building.
He said in well-run shelters, the users do feel safe and secure. The problem is the Assembly, the mayor's office, and neighborhoods can't agree on where to put a shelter. Since 2021, at least three viable options have been sidelined. Rivera is trying again. He wants to get the public more involved to build wider support for a permanent shelter concept. He says it would be run with higher standards and better policies for minimizing neighborhood impacts than past emergency shelters. Earlier this month, Rivera hosted three town halls about what a new shelter should look like. There were lots of empty seats. East Anchorage resident Walter Listener was one of only about 24 people across all three events who stepped up to the mic.
Look how many people are here. It's very discouraging. There's no reason there should be at least 200 people here. No reason. Out of 300,000, residents.
The people who did show up shared grievances and fears about homeless people, judgments about substance use and idleness. A few comments were focused on shelter concepts. In an interview this week, Rivera says he was also hoping for better turnout. This week, Rivera's committee finished a draft resolution with screening criteria for a new shelter. It includes things like square footage per user, proximity to public transportation, distance from schools and playgrounds. He plans for an assembly public hearing and vote on July 11th. Then he'll put together a list of specific locations for a potential shelter and hold another round of town halls leading up to a final assembly decision to pick a site. He expects better participation then. He thinks Anchorage at large does care enough to support solutions to homelessness.
I have to believe that. Even if it isn't true, I feel like me as an elected representative has the moral imperative to work in this issue despite all odds, despite any opposition, to try to find solutions.
He says for him, it comes down to preventing outdoor deaths in the winter. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
A homelessness advocate with a checkered past who once accidentally floated from Alaska to Russia was shot to death on Thursday. 32-year-old Ryan Dummler is charged with murder in the shooting of 51-year-old John Martin III. According to the charging documents, surveillance video showed Dummler approach Martin, who was lying down in a parking lot. The footage showed Dummler apparently shooting Martin, then heading east to his job at a nearby Burger King. Police found Martin dead with multiple gunshot wounds with 9mm shell casings near him. The videos led them to the restaurant where Dummler was arrested on Thursday. Investigators say they found a 9mm handgun and two ammo magazines in his backpack. Martin sat outside Anchorage City Hall to protest the city's homelessness policies in 2011, prompting then-Mayor Dan Sullivan to propose banning people from sitting or lying on downtown sidewalks. Martin made national headlines in 2018 when he crossed the Bering Sea in a dinghy. Russian authorities detained him as he tried to reach China. Martin had served 8 years for sexual abuse of a foster child. Prosecutors tried him twice after the 2014 crash on the Seward Highway that killed his girlfriend, claiming he was driving drunk, but both juries failed to reach a verdict. Dummler is being held at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. Alaska doesn't have many ticks, for now, but Dr. Micah Hahn, associate professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, says that could change. As winters become milder, the tiny blood-sucking parasites are able to survive further and further north. Hahn says the western deer tick, known for carrying Lyme disease, has found its way up into British Columbia.
We're seeing that the sort of the edge of their population is creeping northward. And that's definitely related to climate change and being able to support populations at higher latitudes.
Alaska does have some native ticks, but human encounters aren't very common. Many prefer feeding on wildlife like voles and squirrels. Hahn says it's important for Alaskans to be informed.
There's lots of room for education. I think a lot of Alaskans don't know that we actually have any ticks in the state.
The Alaska Department of Health issued a report by Hahn on Wednesday detailing the presence of ticks in the state. Hahn says the report is an account of years of research that started back in 2010. In addition to climate modeling, researchers collected over 2,000 ticks, mainly through Hahn's Submit a Tick program. The program started in 2018, lets anyone who finds a tick mail it in a crush-proof container to the state veterinarian's office for identification and pathogen testing. Out of all the ticks they collected, only one carried the bacteria which causes Lyme disease, and it had hitched a ride to Alaska on a dog who'd traveled from New York. Hahn says none of the native tick species they collected carried diseases that could spread to humans. But because they're not currently a threat in Alaska, Hahn says Alaskans might not take proper precautions when traveling to places where ticks are more dangerous. They could bring non-native ticks back with them.
You know, when you're traveling to a part of the United States where there are a lot of ticks, New England, the Southeast, you know, California, you need to be aware of what ticks look like, you know, wear DEET, long pants, socks when you're hiking, and then know how to do a tick check. When you're taking a shower, look all over your body and look for these tiny little ticks that can be, you know, the size of the top of a pinhead.
Hahn also suggests that pet owners ask their vets about tick medication prior to traveling. More information on preventing tick bites can be found on the CDC website. A worsening staffing shortage at the Fairbanks Police Department is forcing a scheduling change. There aren't enough officers to cover all shifts, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the situation is driving tough choices and measures to boost hiring and retention.
The Fairbanks Police Department plans to reduce patrol hours beginning August 1st. FPD Chief Ron Dupuy says the department will no longer have patrol officers on duty between 8 a.m. and noon.
We're going to a 2 10-hour schedule for the patrol officers. So patrol officers will be here starting at noon, and then the second shift will come in at 10 p.m. and work till 8 a.m.
Chief Dupuy notes that there will always be a few officers at the police station, including himself, who can respond to emergencies during the non-patrol hours. He says the schedule change reflects critically low staffing.
This is the first time in my 18 years that we've been down this far.
He says of 44 budgeted FPD positions, only 29 are currently filled, and 13 of those are administrative.
Our patrol officers, the guys that actually are on the street working, we have 16, and 6 of those are on some other kind of assignment, whether they're on administrative duty, some kind of leave. So we really have 10 patrol officers for the city of Fairbanks right now.
They're just running ragged.
FPD Captain Nathan Warner points to a down spiraling effect caused by patrol burnout and limited opportunity to pursue specialized police work like canine, narcotics, or SWAT. Programs, Warner says, benefit the community and police officers.
It creates a quality of life and a progression for a career, so you end up retaining employees.
Captain Warner adds that FPD, like departments across the country, is competing for a dwindling pool of officer candidates. And the current patrol grind, along with less than competitive wages and benefits, has officers leaving faster than replacements can be hired and trained.
We're bleeding officers.
In an effort to turn around the situation, Captain Warner and Chief Dupuy have requested the city use funds budgeted for unfilled positions to attract and retain officers. Meeting Monday, the city council passed an ordinance that triples an existing hiring bonus for experienced officers from $20,000 to $60,000.
The highest lateral transfer bonus system in the state of Alaska.
City Mayor David Pruse told the council the bonus, which is paid in 2 increments over 3 years, is warranted given the critically low staffing situation at FPD.
It's the most immediate fix for the issue.
The city council is considering 2 other measures aimed at boosting officer hire and retention. One would increase the base wage from $34 to $42 an hour. The other would put $10,000 a year into officer retirement accounts, money they could access after 13 years at FPD. It would augment the state's public employee retirement system, which in 2006 eliminated pensions for the latest tier of employees. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
They might not have won $10,000, but they sealed the deal on the most coveted steak knives out there. Team Budgie Smugglers was the second team to cross the Race to Alaska finish line, arriving in Ketchikan around 9 p.m. Thursday. It was a rough day as the 5-person team battled their way to the dock. Crew member Tom Bohannon says they mostly stuck to inside waters. He said he didn't know of any teams that chose to take the outside because of the rough forecast this year.
The nights were by far the hardest. We got becalmed a lot at night and had to use our pedal drives and oars to just keep moving at a really slow pace, which is discouraging at night when you're trying to get up to a light on a point and 3 hours later you're still trying to get up to the light.
Crewman Joe Hodges gave some advice to race hopefuls.
You know, you'd have to bring your A game. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the more serious events I've ever been involved in.
The first place finishers, We Break for Wales, made it to Ketchikan just before 6 a.m. on Wednesday. 3 more teams chased each other to the finish line before Friday afternoon. Team Pesto took 3rd place. Team Dacron and Denim came in 4th. And Team Unfinished Business claimed the 5th place slot.
Support for KMXT comes from GCI. GCI is a participant in the Affordable Connectivity Program, providing qualifying Alaska households entry-level broadband internet. More information at gci.com/ACP.
Signs of a thaw in the U.S.-China relationship? I'm Matt Levin with the Marketplace Minute. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken finally met with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Blinken canceled his trip to Beijing earlier this year after that whole Chinese spy balloon controversy. While the meeting was seen as positive, no major breakthroughs were announced. Swiss voters have approved a minimum corporate tax. That's a victory for the U.S.-led initiative to establish a global minimum corporate tax. Switzerland has long been a low-tax haven for multinational companies. And today's Juneteenth, the federal holiday commemorating the day in 1865 when slaves in Galveston, Texas, learned they were free. This year, at least 28 states will legally recognize Juneteenth as a public holiday. I'm Matt Levin with the Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by JLL, providing commercial real estate investment and technology. See a brighter way.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 19th day of June, the year 2023. Happy Juneteenth. The sun rose today at 5:07. It will set again at 11:14. That will give us 18 hours and 7 minutes, a gain of only 19 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for this date was 78 degrees set in 1926, and a record low was 37 set in cool 1985. 58 degrees currently in Kodiak under mostly cloudy skies. Out at the airport, they are showing northeast winds to 6 miles per hour, 60% humidity, and 10 miles of visibility. Look for mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day with a high near 64, calm winds. 50% chance of rain tonight with mostly cloudy skies and a low of 50, southeast winds to 10. And for Tuesday, rain is likely, mainly after 1 p.m., and that rain is expected to continue overnight Tuesday night and into Wednesday morning, where it'll be replaced by a few scattered snow showers. And they're talking about scattered showers and just a chance of rain for the rest of the week. Looking at our local tides, we have an incoming tide. Our next high tide will be at 4:28 this afternoon here on the east side and be 6.6 feet, followed by a low tide at 9:21 this evening of 3 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 4:38 this afternoon and be 11.6 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 10:08 p.m. of 4.3 feet. Well, let's check in on the latest advisory from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that just came in this morning.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 6, date issued 10 a.m. on June 19th. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, June 20th, until 9 p.m. Thursday, June 22nd, in the following areas. In the Cape Alatak, Humpy Deadman, Alatak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District. There will be a 48-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 9 p.m. Tuesday, June 20th, until 9 p.m. Thursday, June 22nd, in the following areas. In the outer Karluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the central and North Cape sections of the Northwest Kodiak District, and the Southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District. There will be a 33-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, June 21st, until 9 p.m. Thursday, June 22nd, in the following areas. In the northwest Afognak, Paul's Bay, and Paranosa Bay sections of the Afognak District, the Eastside Kodiak District, and the Big River and Outer Kukak Bay sections of the Mainland District. Closed waters are reduced until 9 p.m. Thursday, June 22nd in the following areas. At Kaflia Creek, stream number 262301 to the stream terminus, and at Saltry Creek, stream number 259415 to the stream terminus. As previously announced, the following areas will remain open until further notice. The Inner Katoy Bay, Outer Katoy Bay, Duck Bay, and Izhuit Bay sections of the Afognak District, the Fowl Bay Special Harvest Area, and the Waterfall Bay Special Harvest Area. Fishermen are reminded that in the Kodiak area, including the Mainland District, until further notice, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse anguilla in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Closed waters are reduced until further notice in the following locations: in Fowl Bay to stream terminus at Hidden Lake Creek, stream number 251406, in Waterfall Bay to the stream terminus Little Waterfall Creek, stream number 251822, and to the stream terminus of Big Waterfall Creek, stream number 251821, and in Katoy Bay to the fishing game markers located at Little Katoy and Big Katoy Bays near stream number 252323 and 252324. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart and detailed in Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations. And statistical charts, harvest strategies, and Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. And, of course, most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record-a-phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles offshore. Southwest 20 today, seas to 4 feet, building to 5 feet tonight. For Tuesday and Tuesday night, south 15, seas to 5 feet. Over in the Chillicothe Strait, we have an unfortunate small craft advisory today with southwest winds to 25 knots on our west side and 6-foot seas. For tonight, southwest 20, seas to 5 feet. And for tomorrow, southwest 20, seas to 4 feet. Tuesday night, they're talking about variable 10 and 2-foot seas. The Board of Education will be having a regular meeting tonight at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room. The meeting will also be streamed through BlueJeans. Login information is posted at the Kodiak Island Borough School District's website at www.kibsd.org. Look under the Board of Education tab. If you need any more information, contact the Secretary of the Board of Education at 907-486-7566. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session tomorrow. That meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. And they will also be having a regular meeting on Thursday, also at 7:30 p.m., also in the Public Library's multipurpose room. Both meetings are open to the public, and public members are also encouraged to listen right here at KMXT on 100.1 FM. The meetings will also be web-streamed, and the links and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. If you need more information, contact the City Clerk at 907-486-8636. And also tomorrow, the KMXT Board of Directors will be holding their next regular monthly meeting. That's happening at 6 p.m. right here at the KMXT building on 620 Egan Way. Look for the dish with the big octopus on it next to the high school. The meeting is open to the public, and members are always encouraged to attend. For more information, call us here at the station at 907-486-3181. And you can also attend via Zoom. Call or email gm@kmxt.org for the Zoom link. Upcoming Kodiak Pride events include the LGBTQ-friendly restorative yoga class that's happening on Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at A Balanced Approach. It's a fun LGBTQ-plus-friendly exercise class, and donations for Kodiak Pride will be taken at the door. That's, again, 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday at A Balanced Approach. Also on Thursday, Pride Performance and Confidence Building class at A Balanced Approach. If you're interested in performing or you would just like to build your confidence, join Hazel as she teaches you the basics of all things performance related and how to build your confidence while freely being your best self. That's Thursday at 7 p.m. at A Balanced Approach. And the Kodiak Island Borough School District's Summer Food Service Program is going on. That's happening Monday through Thursday for breakfast and lunch, except for July 4th. They will be closed for the 4th of July. Breakfast is served at 8 a.m. to 9 a.m., and lunch is 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., and they're served in the High School Commons, which is up here on 917 Razanoff Drive.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., and during the Midday Report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.